was astonishingly creative. It managed to give her endless reasons not to go to auditions. It told her how awkward, embarrassed, and anxious she would feel, how much practice she would have to do in order to get better, and how hard, boring, and tedious that would be. It reminded her of all the hassle involved in getting to the locations by public transport and then hanging around for ages, nerves jangling, waiting to be called in. It pointed out all the weaknesses in her dancing and told her she was too lazy and didn't have the willpower or discipline to practice her routines. It compared her to other dancers she knew and pointed out all the ways in which they were more athletic, graceful, or talented. And it told her there was no point in trying because she was sure to fail anyway. By the time Sarah came to see me, she was deeply frustrated. She had a veritable library of self-help books, and she'd followed their advice faithfully. She'd spent many, many hours challenging her negative thoughts, repeating positive affirmations, and visualizing herself stunning the judges with her dance moves. But it didn't stop her mind from churning out lots of reasons to avoid the auditions or avoid practicing her dance routines. We'll return to Sarah later in the chapter, but for now take a few moments to consider. Which types of reason-giving does your mind prefer? My mind uses all of them. The reason-giving machine. Our minds are like reason-giving machines. As soon as we think about making important changes, they crank out a whole list of reasons why we can't do it, shouldn't do it, or shouldn't have to do it. And there's no way to stop our minds from doing this. But don't take my word for it. Check it out for yourself. Set yourself a goal right now, something you will do in the next few days that will take you out of your comfort zone into a genuinely challenging situation. Obviously, pick something that is likely to improve your life. I don't mean anything dangerous like walking down a dark alley late at night. If you have access to a pen and paper or a computer, then write your goal down. If not, just do it in your head. Please phrase your goal using the following structure. My commitment is to take the following action. On, blank, specify the day, date, and time here. I am going to, blank, specify here exactly what actions you will take with your arms, legs, and mouth. Once you've done that, say your goal to yourself, aloud or silently, and as you do so, notice what your mind starts telling you. Did the reason-giving machine crank into action, churning out all the reasons not to do it? I'd be surprised if it didn't, but that's easily fixed. To set the reason-giving machine in motion, all you need to do is up the stakes. Simply make a commitment right now that as soon as you finish this page, you will put the book down and publicly announce your goal, either in person, via telephone, or via email, to somebody whose opinion really matters to you. Now listen into your mind for 20 seconds and notice all the reasons it comes up with. If you did the above exercise, what tactics did you notice your mind using? Obstacles, self-judgments, comparisons, or predictions? If you didn't do it, please take a moment to reflect. Your mind just gave you some reasons to skip the exercise. Can't be bothered. Do it later. Can't think of anything right now. Too hard. Won't matter if I skip this bit. And you got hooked. This is completely normal, by the way. Many readers will have done the same thing as you. It just goes to show how good our minds are at reason-giving. And now that you have that insight, please go back and do the exercise. But what if my thoughts are true? Sometimes when I first talk about reason-giving, my clients protest strongly, but these thoughts are true. They are usually surprised when I reply, "You know, in this approach, it's not about whether our thoughts are true or false. It's about whether they're helpful. If we allow these thoughts to guide our actions, will they help us to achieve the results we want? Will they help us to be the person we want to be? Will they help us to create the life we want to live?" To make this clear, let's revisit the four most common categories of reason giving. 1. Obstacles. Our minds point out all the obstacles and difficulties that lie in our path. We all have obstacles, barriers, and difficulties that get in the way of us doing the things we want to do. And our minds are very effective problem-solving machines. So if your mind is realistically appraising those obstacles and constructively figuring out how to overcome them, then such thoughts are likely to be helpful. For example, suppose the barrier or difficulty is lack of time, and your mind says, yes, I am very busy, so to make time to practice my presentation skills, I'll cut back on the amount of TV I watch. Thoughts like this are likely to be helpful. But if your mind just keeps going over and over all the potential obstacles, complaining about them, shoving them in your face and telling you how hard it all is, without looking for constructive, practical solutions, then those thoughts are likely to be unhelpful. 2. Self-judgments. Our minds point out all the ways in which we're not up to the task. Our minds are good at spotting what can be improved upon, so if our minds are respectfully appraising our skills and constructively advising us as to how we can improve them, that's generally useful. For example, if your mind says, I'm not very good at telling jokes and I'd like to improve, so I'm going to buy a joke book and practice telling jokes to my trusted friends. That's probably helpful. But if your mind just criticizes and judges you, I'm hopeless at socializing, I can't tell jokes for the life of me, I always get flustered and forget the punchline, that's not helpful. 3. Comparisons. Our minds compare us unfavorably to others who seem to do it better, have more talent, or have it easier. The mind is very good at making comparisons. Sometimes it tells us the ways in which we are better than others, and sometimes it tells us the ways in which we are worse. If our minds compare us to others in a respectful and constructive way that allows us to learn, grow, and develop, that's generally helpful. Suppose your mind says, Tiger Woods can golf much better than I can. What sorts of things does he do to improve his game? How much practice does he do? How can I emulate some of those strategies? Allowing those thoughts to guide us will probably be helpful, but if your mind just blathers on about how others are so much better than you, or how much easier they've got it, then that's not likely to be of much use. 4. Predictions. Our minds predict failure, rejection, or other unpleasant outcomes. As you know, our minds evolved to warn us of danger, to anticipate anything that could harm us. So when your mind starts predicting failure or disaster, it's only doing its job. Now, suppose it does this in a constructive manner, realistically appraising the risks, planning how to respond in the worst-case scenario, and reminding us how we can learn from the experience. For example, yes, it's true, if I write this book, there's no guarantee that it will get published. The fact is, many books don't. And even if it does get published, most books make very little money. The odds of it being a bestseller are millions to one. But at least if I write it, I stand a chance. If I don't write it, I stand no chance at all. And in the worst-case scenario, even if it never gets published, I have the satisfaction of knowing I gave it my best shot. Plus, I got to improve my writing skills. Thoughts like this are likely to be helpful. If we let them guide us, they'll take us in the direction we want to go. But if your mind is just broadcasting doom and gloom, there's no point starting, it'll never get published, it's a waste of time, then letting those thoughts guide you is probably not helpful. Notice, in each example above, the helpful thoughts did not involve reason-giving, coming up with all the reasons why we can't do it. Instead, they provided constructive advice on what we can do. Now, once again, pause for a few seconds and notice what your mind has to say about reason-giving. Is your mind objecting? Is it saying, but what if you really can't do it? What if you want to ride a bike but you have no legs? Obviously, if there is a genuinely insurmountable obstacle, you will need to change your goal to a more realistic one. But fortunately, this is rarely the case. We can overcome most obstacles, even if our minds insist that we can't. To quote Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. A very important word. At this point, I'd like to introduce one of the most important words in this book, workability. Please etch this word deep into your brain as it underpins everything we do from this point on. The term workability arises from this simple question: is what you are doing working to help you create a richer, fuller, more meaningful life? If the answer is yes, then what you are doing is workable. If the answer is no, then what you are doing is unworkable. The concept of workability can help us to unhook from our thoughts. If your aim is to empower yourself so you can take effective action and be who you really want to be, but your mind is generating all sorts of reasons why that just can't happen, then you ask yourself this question: if I allow this thought to guide my actions, will it help me create the life I want? If the answer is no, then you can recognize that the thought is unhelpful and that acting on it would be unworkable. It only takes a few seconds to do this, to pause, check in, notice what your mind is saying, and ask yourself the foregoing question. Recognizing a thought or belief as unhelpful often helps to reduce its influence over us. It makes us less likely to act on it. However, note that with this approach, we're not getting into debates about whether the thought is true or false. The question we're interested in is simply this: if I let this thought dictate my actions, will it help me to lead the life I want? A multitude of methods. I'm now going to take you through a whole stack of different diffusion techniques. The first three come from Stephen Hayes's First ACT textbook, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, An Experiential Approach to Behavior Change, so that you can discover which ones best help you to unhook. Some of them may seem a bit weird or wacky, but please try them out and see what happens. In each case, I'll ask you first to fuse with the thought, that is, buy into it, give it all your attention, believe it as much as you can, so that you can get yourself well and truly hooked. Then I'll help you to unhook again. Before we embark, a word of caution. There's no technique in the whole of psychology that always achieves the desired result. While most people find these techniques help them to detach, separate, or get some distance from their thoughts, occasionally the opposite may occur. You may find that the thought starts reeling you in. So adopt an attitude of curiosity toward these exercises. Let go of your expectations and just see what happens. Notice whether the technique helps you to separate from the thought, diffusion, or whether it seems to draw you in even closer, fusion. Note, fusion isn't likely to happen with these exercises. I'm just warning you about it in case it does. If it does, please regard it as a learning opportunity, a chance for you to notice what it's like to get hooked. Then move on to the next exercise. For each exercise, read the instructions through first, then give it a go. And if a particular technique does not work for you, or you simply can't do it, then move on to the next. Exercise 1. I'm having the thought that. Bring to mind a thought that readily hooks you and pulls you away from the life you want to live. Ideally, for this exercise, pick a negative self-judgment that plays a key role in the I can't do it story. For example, I'm not smart enough, or I don't have what it takes, or I'm a loser. Silently say this thought to yourself, believing it as much as you can, and notice the effect it has on you. Now, replay that thought in your head with this short phrase inserted immediately before it. I'm having the thought that. For example, I'm having the thought that I'm a loser. Now replay that thought once more, but this time the phrase to insert is, I notice I'm having the thought that. For example, I notice I'm having the thought that I'm a loser. So what happened? Most people get a sense of distance or separation from the thought. If this didn't happen for you, please try again with another self-judgment. And if you didn't do the exercise at all, please note the reasons your mind gave you to skip it. Then go back and do it anyway. Exercise 2. Singing thoughts. Use the same negative self-judgment as before, or if it has lost its impact, pick a different one. Silently say this thought to yourself, believing it as much as you can, and notice what effect it has on you. Now replay this thought, word for word, singing it to the tune of Happy Birthday. You can either sing it silently or aloud. Now replay that thought once more, but this time sing it to the tune of your choice. What happened this time? Most people find that the sense of distance or separation from the thought is greater than with the first exercise. Some people even find themselves smiling or chuckling, even though that's not the point of the exercise. The point is, when we hear our thoughts sung to music, it helps us to see their true nature. Just like the lyrics in a song, our thoughts are nothing more nor less than words. Of course, thoughts can also occur in the form of pictures or images, but for now we're just dealing with words. Exercise 3. Silly voices. Use the same negative self-judgment as before, or if it has lost its impact, pick a different one. Silently say this thought to yourself, believing it as much as you can. Now replay it, word for word, hearing it in the voice of a cartoon character, movie star, or sports commentator. Now replay it again in yet another distinctive voice, such as that of a Shakespearean actor or a sitcom character. This technique is similar to singing our thoughts. When we hear our thoughts said in different voices, again it helps us to separate from them and recognize that they are nothing more nor less than words. Exercise 4. Computer screen. Use the same negative self-judgment as before, or if it has lost its impact, pick a different one. Silently say this thought to yourself, believing it as much as you can. Now close your eyes, imagine a computer, and see this thought as words on the screen, written in simple black text. Now play around with the font and the color of the text. Don't change the words themselves, just see them in three or four different colors and three or four different fonts. Now put the words back into simple black text, and this time play around with the formatting. First, space the words out, large gaps between them. Now run all the words together, no gaps between them. Now run the words vertically down the screen, underneath each other. Finally, put the words back into simple black text, and this time add in a karaoke ball, bouncing from word to word, back and forth. And, if you like, just for good measure, also sing the thought to the tune of your choice. This exercise tends to be more effective for more visually oriented people. Again, hopefully it helps you to separate or distance from your thought, to see that it is constructed out of words. Now, once again, tune into your mind, and for 10 seconds, notice what it's telling you. So how's your mind reacting? Maybe it's excited. Wow, that was amazing. Or maybe it's all worked up. How can he say that thoughts are just words? They're true. This guy's patronizing me. He doesn't get how it is for me. He doesn't understand the way these thoughts kick me around. Or maybe it's a bit disappointed. These techniques are just silly tricks. They're not going to help me. Whatever your mind is doing, please allow it to have its reaction. And if that reaction is particularly strong and unhelpful, then I invite you to try something. It's a little technique developed by Steve Hayes called thanking your mind. Whatever your mind says, no matter how provocative, nasty, or scary it may be, you silently reply with a sense of humor, "Thanks, mind." You can, of course, vary this as desired. For example, "Thanks for sharing," or "Thanks, mind, good story." Personally, it's one of my favorite diffusion exercises, so play around with it and see what you think. Remember, we're not trying to stop our minds from having these reactions. This technique is simply to help us detach from those thoughts. The power of words. You've probably heard the quotation, "The pen is mightier than the sword." This saying succinctly reminds us that words can have an enormous influence over our behavior. For example, books, scriptures, and manifestos can, in certain situations, shape entire nations far more powerfully than violence, bloodshed, and warfare. Likewise, in a state of fusion, those words inside our heads can have a huge impact upon us. They can dredge up panic or despair. They can feel like a kick in the gut or a plank on our chest. They can drag us down into the depths and sap all our strength. However, in a state of diffusion, our thoughts are nothing more nor less than words. Hopefully, you got to experience that, at least to some degree, in the previous exercises. If you didn't, no matter, we'll be doing some more diffusion very soon. In ACT, we do not belittle your challenges or patronize you. We don't try to deny the powerful impact that thoughts can have on our actions. We simply aim to empower you to increase the choices available to you in your life. Once we can diffuse from our thoughts, that is, separate from them and see them for what they are, we have many more options in life. No longer are we at the mercy of our minds, pushed around by ingrained patterns of unhelpful automatic thinking. Instead, we can choose to pursue what truly matters to us, even when our minds make it hard with all that reason-giving. Exercise 5. if your hands were your thoughts. Many people misunderstand the point of defusion. They either think it's a way of getting rid of negative thoughts or a way of controlling your feelings, but it's neither. Here's an exercise to clarify what it's for. To do this, you'll need to position the book in such a way that you can read the instructions while keeping both your hands free to do the exercise. For example, you might spread it flat on a desktop and use a paperweight to keep the pages open. Alternatively, you could memorize the instructions or have someone else read them out to you. In this exercise, pretend that your hands are your thoughts. Place them in front of you, palms upward, side by side, as if they were the open pages of a book. Ever so slowly, raise them up toward your face. Gradually bring them closer until they are covering your eyes. Keeping your hands over your eyes, look at the world around you. How much are you missing out on? Imagine going around all day like this. How hard would it be to act effectively and do the things that make your life work? Now, ever so slowly, lower your hands. As the gap between your hands and face increases, notice what happens. How much better is your view of the world around you? How much more information can you take in? How much more effectively can you act? Now let your hands rest. Notice they have not disappeared. They are still with you. If there's some way you can use them to improve your life, you are free to use them. If there's nothing they're useful for right now, you can give them some space to rest and just let them be. So here you see the two main purposes of defusion. Firstly, it enables us to be present, to connect with the world around us and fully engage in whatever we are doing. Secondly, it enables us to take effective action. Obviously, if our thoughts are helpful, we will make use of them. But if they're not, we'll just give them plenty of space and let them be. To develop genuine confidence, we need to be fully present and engaged in whatever we are doing, whether it's playing golf, giving a speech, making conversation, or making love. And we also need to be capable of effective action. Defusion enables both of these things. So why do some people totally get the wrong idea? Why do they think defusion is a clever way to get rid of negative thoughts? Because very often, when we defuse from a thought, it disappears. And often, over time, it shows up with lesser frequency. However, this is just a bonus. It's a byproduct of defusion, not the main purpose. Other people mistake defusion as a way of controlling unpleasant feelings. Why? Because often when we defuse from negative thoughts, we feel better, calmer, or happier. But again, this is just a lucky bonus, not the main aim, and it certainly won't always happen. The purpose of defusion is this: to be present and take effective action. So here's my guarantee. If you start using diffusion techniques to try to get rid of negative thoughts or to control how you feel, you'll soon be disappointed or frustrated. Why? Well, firstly, it won't work. Sure, it may work as a quick fix technique in an unchallenging situation, but once you get into the real-life challenging situation, it will not have the desired effect. Secondly, if you're trying to control how you feel, then you've once again gotten stuck inside the confidence gap. Once again, you're playing by the wrong rules. I have to feel confident before I do what matters, or I have to get rid of negative thoughts and reduce my fear or anxiety before I can behave like the person I want to be. So one more time, for good measure, the purpose of defusion is to help us be present and take effective action. This gives us the third rule for the confidence game. Rule 3. Negative thoughts are normal. Don't fight them. Defuse them. The power of practice. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Improving our lives requires committed action. That often means learning new skills or working on old ones. And obviously, if we want to become skillful at anything, we need to practice. This goes for psychological skills as well as physical ones. We can't develop good diffusion skills without practice. And we all need these skills because the reason-giving machine is here to stay. It's not going to suddenly transform into your own personal cheerleader or motivational guru. It's going to keep on telling you multiple versions of the I can't do it story. So are you willing to practice the techniques in this chapter? What I'm asking you to do is very simple. The moment you notice you've been hooked by an unworkable thought, acknowledge it. Silently say to yourself, "Just got hooked." then replay the thought using any technique you like. I'm having the thought that, singing thoughts, silly voices, or the computer screen. And keep in mind, these techniques are like training wheels on a bicycle. You won't have to go for the rest of your life singing your thoughts to Happy Birthday or hearing them in the voice of Homer Simpson. This is just a convenient place to start. I invite you to do this as an experiment, letting go of any expectations you may have and bringing an attitude of genuine curiosity to your experience. Notice what happens or doesn't happen. Don't expect any miraculous overnight changes. And if you do notice high expectations popping up, then gently unhook yourself. For example, you might say, I'm having the thought that this should magically solve all my problems. At times, you may be hooked for hours before you realize it, worrying, ruminating, overanalyzing, or stressing out. No problem. The moment you realize you're hooked, gently acknowledge it. Hooked again. Then pick the thought that's hooking you the most and replay it with the technique of your choice. So, are you willing to give it a go? Just pause for 10 seconds and again, notice what your mind is saying. What's it doing this time? Is it all revved up and eager to practice? Or is it cranking out reasons not to do it? It's too silly, it won't work, I'll do it later, I can't be bothered, it doesn't really matter, and so on. If the latter, no surprises there, let your mind try its best to dissuade you, then do it anyway. And if you should at some point find yourself hooked by all that reason-giving, then you know the drill. Acknowledge, just got hooked, then do a replay. I recommend you use these techniques at least 5 times a day to begin with. The more often, the better. And if you don't use them, notice how your mind talked you out of it. Did it come up with some really good new reasons, or did it pull out the same old ones it's been using for years? The good thing is, you'll have plenty of material to practice with, because your mind is... Chapter 6. Never Short of Words. Poisonous black smoke drifts over the city. The people see it and run toward the river, thousands of them jumping into it like rats, and those that run too slowly start dropping like flies. At least that's how they described it on the radio. On October 30th, 1938, CBS Radio broadcast a program called The War of the Worlds, a dramatization of H.G. Wells's famous novel about Martians invading Earth. The one-hour episode was written, directed, and narrated by the up-and-coming actor Orson Welles. The first two-thirds of the show consisted of fake news bulletins, reporters describing the Martian attacks live from the scene. Many listeners missed the start of the show and so failed to realize that it was only a radio play. They heard the breaking news and thought the Martians really were attacking. Mass panic ensued. The next day, the New York Times reported, "In Newark, in a single block at Hedden Terrace and Hawthorne Avenue, more than 20 families rushed out of their houses with wet handkerchiefs and towels over their faces to flee from what they believed was to be a gas raid. Some began moving household furniture. Throughout New York, families left their homes, some to flee to nearby parks. Thousands of persons called the police, newspapers and radio stations, here and in other cities of the United States and Canada, seeking advice on protective measures against the raids." To listeners who knew the show was just a play, the words coming out of the radio were not a problem. But for listeners who took the words literally, the experience was terrifying. This provides a good analogy for the point I made in the previous chapter, that the words inside our head are not a problem. The problem lies in the way we respond to them. If we fuse with those words, they can easily cause us difficulties. But if we defuse, they don't. If you've been practicing the techniques from the previous chapter, you'll know what I'm talking about. In some ways, the mind is like a radio. Have you noticed how it's always got something to say? It's always got an opinion, an idea, a prediction, a judgment, a criticism, a comparison, or a complaint. It's like listening to talk radio all day long. Sure, from time to time it quietens down, but it soon starts up again, doesn't it? Blah, 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 blah. It doesn't even stop broadcasting when we're asleep. However, this similarity to a radio gives us a simple method for unhooking ourselves. Radio Triple F. It's time to revisit your life change list from Chapter 1, the list of what you'll do differently as you develop confidence. Now pick one of the things on that list and for a few seconds imagine starting to do it today. No matter how tiny the step you take, writing the opening line of that novel, downloading the enrollment form for that course, rehearsing what you'll say when you ask that special person out on a date, imagine yourself taking that first step today. Do this now for about 30 seconds. Now, stop and notice, what is your mind doing? Is it reason-giving, telling you the I can't do it story? If your mind is being very positive, enjoy it. Most readers, though, will find that their minds are saying something unhelpful. Now, what if your mind really were a radio station? For many people, it would sound a little bit like this. Welcome to Radio Triple F, Fear, Flaws and Failure. Regular bulletins on everything you need to fear. Keeping you updated on all your flaws. Around-the-clock reminders about failure. We're here for you all day, every day. If this sounds a bit like your mind, good. That's a sign that you have a normal human mind. Of course, it doesn't always broadcast doom and gloom. At times it can be very helpful, and later in the book we'll look at how to use it to our advantage. Not with positive thinking, but with effective thinking. But for now, let's face reality. Our minds evolved to think negatively. And the bigger and more immediate the challenges we face, the more likely we are to hear Radio Triple F. So how can we unhook ourselves? The first step is simply to notice we've been hooked. The second step is to name what's going on. A sense of humour can really help here. For example, we could say, aha, here's Radio Triple F broadcasting again. Or just, Radio Triple F. Or simply, oops, hooked again. Often these two steps give us enough diffusion from our thoughts to enable us to re-engage in the world and do what matters. However, we can diffuse even further if desired. A third step is to imagine that your mind is a radio and your thoughts are like a voice coming out through the speakers. You could even try hearing your thoughts in the voice of your favourite newscaster or sports commentator, and recognize that you've heard this broadcast many times. Why not try this out right now? Remember that life change list from Chapter 1, the ways you want to act differently, the things you want to do differently, the goals you want to achieve, and so on. Read through the list now, or go back to that chapter and remind yourself of your answers. Then pick something on the list that you can make a start on immediately. Think of some small, simple actions you can take today that would get you moving in the direction you want to go. Once you've done that, just pause, and for 20 seconds, notice what your mind is doing. So what's your mind telling you? If it's being helpful, fantastic, go and get started. But if your mind is being unhelpful, try this technique out right now. A. Notice what your mind is saying. B. Name it. Here's Radio Triple F. C. Hear your thoughts as if they were coming from a radio. So what happened? If you didn't find it much use, not to worry. There are hundreds of other diffusion techniques. You can even invent your own, as we'll see. Three steps to diffusion. All diffusion techniques involve one or more of the following steps. When a thought hooks us, we can 1. Notice it. 2. Name it. 3. Neutralize it. Let's quickly look at each step. 1. Notice it. Noticing our thoughts is always the first step in diffusion, and often it's enough to do the job by itself. If you pause for a second and notice what your mind is doing, that opens a little space between you and your thoughts, often enough for them to lose some of their influence over you. 2. Name it. When we name the type of thoughts we're having, that often helps us to diffuse from them. There are many ways to do this. You tried a couple of techniques in the previous chapter. Aha, here's reason giving. Or here's the I can't do it story. Or I'm having the thought that... You can silently say anything to yourself that names this particular pattern of thinking. For example, if you catch yourself worrying, you may say, worrying again. If you catch yourself imagining the worst, you may say, imagining the worst. If you catch yourself getting caught up in negative self-judgments, you may say, judging again. It's more effective if you can do this with a sense of humour, as if you are smiling in recognition, giving yourself a knowing wink. Aha! Just got hooked again. You can also use metaphors to name your thinking. For example, if your mind is trying to boss you around like a fascist dictator, you might say to yourself, "There goes the fascist dictator." Or if your mind is being very pessimistic, you might say, "Ah, yes, Mr. Doom and Gloom is on the podium." 3. Neutralize it. This is an optional step that gives room for a huge amount of creativity. I use the word neutralize to mean taking your thoughts and putting them into a new context where you can see them clearly for what they are. Nothing more than pictures and words, nothing you need to fight with, cling to, or run from. In the previous chapter, you did this in several different ways, silently singing your thoughts, hearing them in silly voices, putting them onto a computer screen. And in this chapter, you've imagined them as a broadcast on the radio. However, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of ways to do this. Here are a few ideas to stimulate your creative juices. I encourage you to play around with them, see how they work for you, and see if you can come up with some of your own. You could visualize the thought as a caption on a birthday card, or a slogan on a t-shirt, or graffiti on a wall. You could say the thought aloud in a squeaky voice or a foreign accent, or sing it to the tune of your choice. You might write it down, draw it, or paint it, or perhaps imagine yourself painting it on a canvas. You might visualize your thoughts as the credits of a movie scrolling up the screen, or maybe even floating through space as in the Star Wars movies. You can place your thoughts on clouds and let them drift across the sky, or put them on the sides of suitcases on a conveyor belt. You could imagine an actor reading your thoughts from a script. Or you could imagine them as text messages, emails, or pop-ups on the internet. And if you came up with a metaphor in step 2, such as the fascist dictator, or Mr. Doom and Gloom in step 3, you could take it further. You might actually imagine a fascist dictator saying your thoughts out loud, giving a speech to a crowd of fanatic followers. Or you might imagine Mr. Doom and Gloom as a character in a comic book and see your thoughts popping up inside his speech bubbles. Basically, you can do anything that helps you step back and see that thoughts are nothing more nor less than mental events, constructions of words and pictures, transient and ever-changing. The P word. I encourage you to play with diffusion throughout the day so that you can get better and better at unhooking yourself. Remember, if we want to become good at anything, there's no getting around the need to practice. So in addition to practicing these ultra-quick diffusion exercises, I invite you to try a longer one, also by Stephen Hayes, called Leaves on a Stream. Ideally, you'd practice this for 5 to 10 minutes, once or twice a day. The more, the better. Many people find it works well to slot 5, 10, or 15 minutes into a lunch break, or to do it first thing in the morning as soon as they're out of bed. Please read through the instructions at least twice, then give it a go. And if you'd like a recording of this exercise to help guide you through it, you'll find it on track 2 of my CD, Mindfulness Skills, Volume 1, available as a CD or MP3 from www.thehappinesstrap.com. Leaves on a Stream. Note, if you have difficulty visualizing, that is, creating images and pictures in your head, then you will need to modify this exercise. You'll find out how as you read on. 1. Find a comfortable position, sitting or lying, and either close your eyes or fix them on a spot. 2. Imagine a gently flowing stream. 3. Imagine there are leaves floating on the surface of the water. 4. For the next 5 minutes, take every thought that pops into your head, whether it's a picture or a word, place it on top of a leaf, and let it float on by. 5. If you find visualization hard, or you can't get the stream to look the way you want it to, then instead imagine an expanse of black space, and imagine there's a gently blowing breeze. Take each thought that pops into your head, release it into the breeze, and let it float off into the blackness. Alternatively, you could imagine a moving black strip, like a conveyor belt, and place your thoughts on that. 6. Do this for each and every thought, whether it is happy or sad, positive or negative, optimistic or pessimistic. You may find yourself trying to hold on to the happy, positive, optimistic thoughts. If so, remember that the purpose of the exercise is to improve your ability to unhook yourself, to let go of your thoughts. So if you want to get good at this, you need to practice on every thought that arises, both pleasant and unpleasant, helpful and unhelpful. Not for the rest of your life, just while doing this exercise. 7. You are not aiming to get rid of the thoughts. You are aiming to step back and watch their natural flow. So if you start speeding up the stream, trying to wash them all away, you are defeating the purpose. 8. If your thoughts stop, just watch the stream or the blackness. It won't be long before they start again. 9. If your mind says this is silly or it's too hard or I can't do it, put those thoughts on leaves too. 10. Most people get hooked early on by thoughts like, I'm not doing it properly, or it's flowing too fast, or I can't get the stream to look the way I want. When you notice you've been hooked by such a thought, simply restart the exercise and put that thought on a leaf. 11. If a leaf or a thought gets stuck and doesn't move on, let it stay. Don't fight with it. Sometimes thoughts hang around for a while before they eventually move on. 12. If an uncomfortable feeling shows up, such as boredom, frustration, impatience, or anxiety, just acknowledge it. Silently say to yourself, noticing boredom or noticing frustration, and then place those words on a leaf. 13. From time to time, you'll get hooked and pull out of the exercise. You'll get stuck planning your holidays or running through your to-do list or rehashing that quarrel you recently had with your partner, or thinking about that movie you saw last night, or remembering that stream you used to play in as a child. This is only natural. Our minds are experts at hooking us. The moment you realize you've been hooked, silently acknowledge it. Hooked again. Then start up the exercise again from the beginning. Please read the foregoing instructions as many times as you need to until you know what to do, then give it a go. 5 minutes is ideal for a first run-through, but you can do more or less as you desire. So how did you find that? Did you actually do it, or did the reason-giving machine get the better of you? Did you get repeatedly hooked and pulled out of the exercise? If so, that's absolutely normal and only to be expected. Our minds are very creative, they have many different ways of interfering, and not just with this exercise, with all of them. However, each time you realize you've been hooked and proceed to unhook yourself again, you are developing a valuable skill. People have a wide range of reactions to this exercise. Some folks love it, others hate it, most lie somewhere in between. I did not like it very much at first, but I found that after a couple of weeks of daily practice, I came to enjoy it. Many of my clients have found the same. So I encourage you to persist at least for a week or two. And how will this practice help you develop confidence? Let's think it through. Just imagine. You've done it. You've taken the plunge. You've stepped out of your comfort zone and put yourself into that challenging situation. You're about to give that talk, or ask that person for a date, or write the first sentence of that book. You're mingling at the party, waiting for the whistle to start the game, or waiting to go through that door for your big interview. Your fight-or-flight response has kicked in, and your mind is now going into a tailspin. Maybe it's predicting disaster. Maybe it's telling you that you can't handle it. Maybe it's simply piling on the pressure, warning you of what's at stake and what could go wrong. And yet, it's not a problem. Those thoughts just float on by like leaves on a stream. You don't have to challenge them or squash them. You just let them come and go as if they were merely cars driving past outside your house. Because you're not investing any effort in fighting them, disputing them, or suppressing them, you can now put your energy into taking effective action. And because you're not entangled in your thoughts, you can engage fully in whatever it is that you're doing. Of course, we wouldn't practice leaves on a stream while we're in the middle of a challenging situation, or we wouldn't be able to act effectively. Leaves on a stream is merely a training exercise to help develop the skill of diffusion. Once this skill is developed, we can go into challenging situations and diffuse from our thoughts spontaneously without needing to rely on such techniques. Remember Sarah, the dancer we spoke about in Chapter 5? In the past, whenever she attended an audition, she'd get so entangled in thoughts of failure, she'd be unable to focus on what she was doing. As a result, she wouldn't dance very well, and she'd fail the audition, a self-fulfilling prophecy. However, once she started practicing leaves on a stream every day for 20 minutes, she soon noticed a huge difference. At auditions, her mind would still generate plenty of thoughts about failure, but she was able to let them come and go without getting wrapped up in them. She could focus on her routine and danced much better. Did this help her self-confidence? You bet it did. Now, pause for 20 seconds and notice what your mind is telling you. Is the reason giving machine cranking up? Is Radio Triple F doing a broadcast? Is your mind telling you some version of the I can't do it story? If so, no surprises there. So thank your mind for those thoughts and carry on reading. On the other hand, if your mind is being positive and encouraging, enjoy it. Remember, the mind is a double-edged sword. At times it will generate thoughts that are helpful, and at other times it will do the very opposite. And sometimes it will even do both simultaneously. So enjoy it when your mind is being helpful, but don't come to rely on it, because it can change like the wind. And especially, be alert for... Chapter 7, The Self-Esteem Trap. In the great Wall Street crash of 1929, bankrupt businessmen leaped from the rooftops of their buildings, and in 2009, Michael knew exactly how they felt. 1 year earlier, Michael had been the director of a hugely profitable company, but now everything had changed. The global financial crisis had crippled his business, and he was now forced to sell it at a major loss. Michael was in a truly wretched state, miserable, hopeless, and defeated, a far cry from how he'd felt 12 months earlier. When he had been doing well, at the top of his game, he thought of himself as a winner. And not surprisingly, that made him feel good. But now the tide had turned, now his mind kept telling him he was a loser. And that, surprise, surprise, did not feel so good. Michael was painfully caught in the self-esteem trap. Falling into the trap. Our society often encourages us to think in terms of winners and losers, successes and failures, champions and underachievers. We frequently encounter all sorts of books, articles and experts that tell us, think like a winner, be a success, winners do this and losers do that. If we get hooked by the story that we're a winner, a champion or a success, there may well be some short-term benefits. For example, we may get to feel good about ourselves for a while, especially if we compare ourselves to some loser, failure, or quitter. But how long does that feeling last? How long before our minds find someone else who is achieving more or being more successful than us? And when our minds inevitably locate that other person and start comparing, what happens next? That's right, now our minds call us the loser or the failure. You may have heard of the concept of fragile self-esteem. It's something very common in successful professionals and athletes. As long as they achieve all their goals, they can hold on tightly to the I'm a winner story, and they get to feel good about themselves. But the moment their performance drops, and sooner or later it will, the story instantly changes to I'm a loser. And if they're in the habit of holding on tight to self-judgments, then they get reeled in to the black hole of I'm a loser. So the winner's-loser's mindset is inherently problematic. It creates a desperate need to achieve, fueled by the fear of becoming a loser or a failure. This in turn leads to chronic stress, performance anxiety, or burnout. And consider this too. When someone holds on tightly to, I'm a winner in the long term, what effect does that have on their relationships? Have you ever tried to build a good quality relationship based on openness, respect, and equality with someone hooked on their own positive self-judgments, someone completely fused with, I am a success, I am a champion, or I am a winner? We read all the time about rock stars, movie stars, supermodels, and other famous people who take their own press too seriously and start to believe they really are better than everyone else. And we see how much tension and stress they create with their narcissistic, egocentric behavior. Contrast these folks with Nelson Mandela, who said in one interview, "That was one of the things that worried me, to be raised to the position of a semi-god, because then you are no longer a human being. I wanted to be known as Mandela, a man with weaknesses, some of which are fundamental." The self-esteem myth. The self-esteem industry is worth a small fortune, and it has done an excellent job of selling us on the importance of its products. Once a term used only by psychologists, self-esteem is now a household word, with parents, teachers, therapists, and coaches preaching its many benefits. But does high self-esteem live up to its own reputation? Does it really make us happier, healthier, and more successful? Or have we all been hoodwinked by a seductive sales pitch? First, let's define what high self-esteem actually means, because there is more than one interpretation. By far the most common meaning of high self-esteem is evaluating oneself positively. In other words, making and believing positive self-judgments and self-appraisals. This is often described as prizing, appreciating, or approving of oneself. Now, keeping to this popular meaning of the term, please take the following quiz, answering each statement, true or false. Boosting your self-esteem will improve your performance. People with high self-esteem are more likable, have better relationships, and make a better impression on others. People with high self-esteem make better leaders. Before I give you the answers, let's go back in time to 2003. In that year, the American Psychological Association commissioned a self-esteem task force to investigate if the claims above and many other similar ones were true. So a team of four psychologists from top universities, Roy Baumeister, Jennifer Campbell, Joachim Kruger, and Kathleen Voss, systematically ploughed through decades of published research on self-esteem. They looked long and hard for firm scientific evidence to either confirm or refute these popular beliefs. Then they published their results in an influential journal called Psychological Science in the Public Interest. And what did they find? All three of the above statements are false. They also found the following. High self-esteem correlates with egotism, narcissism, and arrogance. High self-esteem correlates with prejudice and discrimination. High self-esteem correlates with self-deception and defensiveness when faced with honest feedback. And as if this news weren't bad enough by itself, cast your mind back to the research I cited in Chapter 3, when people with low self-esteem try to boost it through positive self-affirmations, they generally end up feeling even worse. So, if trying to raise self-esteem is not worth the effort, then what's the alternative? Self-acceptance. Self-acceptance, self-awareness, and self-motivation are all far more important than self-esteem. For now, we're going to focus on self-acceptance. We'll cover the others in later chapters. Why is self-acceptance so important? Because when we step out of our comfort zones, things won't always turn out the way we desire. At times, we will make mistakes and screw things up. At other times, things will go wrong when we least expect it. And although sometimes we will achieve our goals quite easily, sometimes we are bound to fail dismally. This is a fact of life, no matter how talented or dedicated we may be. Michael Jordan, commonly acclaimed as the greatest basketball player of all time, provides a good example. He says, "I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life. That is why I succeed." We can easily agree with this intellectually. Yes, we can say that makes good sense. Making mistakes is an essential part of the learning process. However, when it actually happens, when we really do screw up, our minds are generally not so agreeable. At these times, the mind's default setting is to beat us up, to pull out a big stick and give us a whacking. Now, here's the million-dollar question. If beating yourself up were a good way to change your behavior, wouldn't you be perfect by now? Just think back over all the floggings, hidings, and beatings your mind has doled out over your lifetime. Did they really help you? Or did they just make you feel bad? And even if they did get you off your butt in the short term, did they sustain your commitment in the long term? Flogging ourselves for failure is largely a waste of time. It saps our strength and vitality and makes it hard to learn and grow from our experiences. A far more empowering response is self-acceptance, which basically means letting go of all self-judgments. Now, Before reading on, just pause for a 10-second check-in and notice what your mind is saying. Did your mind protest or argue? Did it leap up and down with joy? Did it point out all the flaws in my argument, or did it go along with it? Did it have a gripe about all these check-ins? Did it tell you to skip the check-in and carry on reading? Or did it go all quiet on you? All of these are perfectly normal reactions, so please thank your mind and continue reading. Let's return to the phrase, letting go of all self-judgments. When we make a mistake or things go wrong, it's important to assess our actions, reflecting on what we did and what the results were. This is step 3 of the confidence cycle, assess the results. We want to take a good, honest look at what we did and assess it in terms of workability. Remember, workability refers to this question, is what you are doing working to give you a rich and fulfilling life? But this is very different from judging ourselves. Assessing our actions is workable. Judging ourselves is not. Here's an example to draw out the difference. Assessing my actions. When I got caught up in worrying about the shot and lost my focus on the ball, I threw poorly and missed the basket. Judging myself, I am such a lousy basketball player. So self-acceptance does not mean that we pay no attention to the way we behave and the impact of our actions. It simply means we let go of blanket self-judgments. Why would we do this? Because judging ourselves does not help us in any way. It does not work to make our life richer and fuller. Of course, knowing this intellectually won't stop it from happening. Our minds started judging us in early childhood. This pattern is not suddenly going to stop now. But what we can do is unhook ourselves from those self-judgments, and I invite you to start doing this as of now. Practice getting unhooked from all your self-judgments, both the negative and the positive. Let them float by like leaves on a stream. If your mind's telling you how deficient you are, notice it and name it judgment. And if your mind's telling you how wonderful you are, notice it and name it judgment. Remember, we don't want to hold on tightly to the positive or the negative self-judgments. We want to let go of them all. Also, feel free to be light-hearted with your naming. For example, when you notice a positive self-judgment, you might playfully say to yourself, "That's a lovely bit of flattery. Thanks, mind."